It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll learn about efforts to lower gas prices in the U.S. and how well they might work. First, you've probably racked up at least a few regrets in your life. They might be small things, like wishing you left earlier when you're running late for something. Or they could be bigger things, like wishing you had the courage to ask someone out or that you chose a different career. Our next guest says those regrets are a core part of what makes us human. He says if we understand regret better, we can actually use it to our advantage. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Hey, if you're willing to share, do you have a regret that's been hard for you to let go of? Or have you been able to take a regret and learn from it for the next time? Have you learned things from your regrets over time? How have they changed the way you act now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Daniel Pink is a New York Times bestselling author. His latest book is The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, you lay this out right off the bat in your book. A lot of people love the concept of no regrets. Some of us even get it tattooed on ourselves. Why does this no regret idea become so widespread?
Well, I think it's because we're a little bit over-indexed on positivity. We think that we need to be positive all the time. We think that we should be looking forward all the time, that we should never look back, that when we experience a negative emotion, or particularly a negative emotion like regret, we should brush it off, think positive, and move on. And the trouble with that philosophy, that no regrets philosophy, is that it runs against 50 years of science, and it's a terrible blueprint for living.
Why? Why is that a terrible blueprint for living?
Well, because regrets serve a function. Here's the thing. Regret is one of our most ubiquitous emotions. It is one of the most common emotions human beings have. It's arguably the most common negative emotion human beings have. There's 50 years of evidence showing that the only people who truly don't have regrets, right, who actually are true to this no regrets philosophy are five-year-olds because their brains haven't developed enough, people with certain kinds of brain lesions and neurodegenerative disorders, and sociopaths. The rest of us have regrets. And, you know, I don't like experiencing regret. Nobody does. So there's this puzzle about why is something so unpleasant, so widespread? And the reason is it's useful if we treat it right. And the problem is we haven't been taught how to treat it right. We think of it as something to ignore. When we can't ignore our regrets, we end up wallowing them. What we should be doing is confronting our regrets, thinking about them, using them as engines of progress.
All right. How do we do that? I look back at some of my life. I regret A, I probably don't want to think about it. As you say, B, if I start thinking about it, I wallow in it. How do I steer that better course?
We have a lot of evidence on how to do that more effectively. It begins with how we think about ourselves and our regret. When we talk to ourselves in the face of missteps and screw-ups, we are brutal. Our self-talk is vicious and cruel, and the solution to that is stop doing that. Instead, practice something called self-compassion. Self-compassion is treating yourself with kindness rather than contempt, recognizing that your regrets are part of the human condition. You're actually not that special. If you have a regret about kindness or lack of boldness, it's very, very common. And also our mistakes are a moment in time, not the full measure of our life. And so once we treat ourselves with self-compassion, we can begin to talk about our regret, make sense of our regret, and systematically extract a lesson from it that we can apply next time.
Talking to Daniel Pink about his new book, The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Is there something in your life that you regret and that you're willing to share? Do you feel like you wallow in it? Do you try to forget about it? Or have you learned from it? Do you have questions for a guest about this, the science of regret? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dan, you've done these massive surveys, first in the United States, then a worldwide one looking at regret. What are some of the most common big regrets that people express in these surveys?
Well, what I found and actually look at, so thank you for mentioning that. So I did one big giant public opinion poll of the U.S. population that showed that when you look at sort of the main areas of people's lives, people regret a lot of different kinds of stuff. They have regrets about careers. They have regrets about education. They have regrets about health. But then I also did something called the World Regret Survey, where I just collected regrets a lot. We now have over 20,000 regrets from people in 109 countries. And what I found there, when you actually go beyond the domains of life, and I read through the first 15,000 of these, is that around the world, over and over again, people seem to share the same four regrets. Over and over again, they express the same four regrets. They have less to do with the part of life you're in, career, education, whatever, and more to do with, I think, some fundamental human longings and aspirations.
What are those main longings and aspirations that that will lead us into this path of regret?
Well, I'll go through them very quickly. Foundation regrets. Foundation regrets are, if only I'd done the work. These are people who have regrets about saving too little, spending too much, about not taking care of their health, about not working hard enough in school. Again, small decisions early that add up to calamitous consequences later. Second category, boldness regrets. Boldness regrets are, if only I'd taken the chance. Again, this spans the domains of life. You mentioned one at the top of the show, Rob. Well, a lot of people regret not asking somebody out on a date. But these are people who regret not traveling, people who regret not starting a business, people who regret not speaking up. They're at a moment in their life when they can play it safe or take the chance. They don't take the chance, not always, but often they regret it. Third category, moral regrets. If only I'd done the right thing. These are regrets about bullying, marital infidelity, other kinds of transgressions. And finally, the fourth category, connection regrets. If only I'd reached out. They're relationships, it's regrets about relationships that have come apart or should have been intact or were intact and are no longer intact. And somebody wants to reach out, but they say it's going to be awkward. The other side's not going to care. And so they don't do it, and it drifts apart further. And with remarkable regularity, people express these same four regrets.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jake is with us in Appleton. Jake, hello.
I have a question. What can we do, or what are some mechanisms when we find ourselves loathing, maybe in some of these regretful type thoughts? Any help for our viewers or listeners, rather? Thanks.
Sure. Sure, Jake. So as I was mentioning earlier, one of the best things you can do is to stop. The first thing is to stop that march toward rumination. And the way to do that is to treat yourself with the same generosity and kindness and empathy you would treat somebody else. If a friend of you came to you and said, "Oh, Jake, I made this mistake," you typically wouldn't say, "You idiot, what's wrong with you? You're the worst person in the world." But that's how we talk to ourselves. And as I said before, don't do that. Treat yourself with kindness. Recognize that these mistakes, these regrets are part of the human condition. The second thing you can do, and it's really important, is to talk about it or write about the regret. When we talk about a regret or write about it, we unburden ourselves. What's more, we do something profoundly important for negative emotions. We take this abstraction, this blobby negative feeling, convert it to words, and then that's far less fearsome. These concrete words are less fearsome than the abstract emotion. And finally, we have to draw a lesson from it. We have to be explicitly draw a lesson from it. And a good way to do that is to get some remove from it and ask yourself, what would I tell my best friend to do in this situation? Or what would I want to have done 10 years from now? And so when we reframe inward and treat ourselves with kindness, when we express outward and make sense of it, and then when we move forward by drawing a lesson from it, we can begin to develop a habit of using our regrets as an engine for progress. And when we do that, there is a massive amount of evidence that it helps us in profoundly important ways. I mean, even in more reductively narrow ways, it helps us become better negotiators. It helps us become better problem solvers. It helps us become better parents. The problem is no one has taught us how to do that. And it's a very simple process.
Thanks for that question, Jake. We're talking to author Daniel Pink. His new book is called The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you try to live your life with no regrets? How is that working for you? Or have you made a point of learning from regrets, things that you see as mistakes in your past and trying to get it better the next time around? Or do you have questions about how all this regret stuff works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with author Daniel Pink about his latest book, The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. You could join in to share regrets you've had, how you've overcome them or dealt with them, or your questions about regret. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Joel on Facebook writes, "We cannot change the past, but we can certainly learn from it. Holding on to regrets or resentments destroys our ability to enjoy today." What do you think? Share your thoughts. Dan, something that struck me in your book, you share a lot of regrets that people shared in your surveys. One story that really stuck with me when it comes to Joel's comment about learning from our regrets, a woman who talked about regretting that she hadn't listened to her grandparents more, enjoyed time spent with them until it was too late, they'd passed away. She took that, though, and said, okay, as my parents age, I'm going to make sure to listen, and I'm going to make sure to take that time. Can you talk about that as an example of how we can use our regret?
Sure. It's a great story. This is a woman named Abby who lives in Phoenix, Arizona. And when she was growing up, her grandparents, who lived in Indiana, would come and visit for a couple of months a year to, you know, because Arizona winters are far more pleasant than Indiana winters. And when she was a kid, she hated it. She resented them being there. And then they passed away and she realized she had screwed up. And what she missed was the connection, the stories. And what she decided to do is, again, this is a great example. She could ignore it, say, no regrets, no regrets. Look positive, be positive, look forward, right? Or she could say, oh my God, I'm a horrible human being. This is the worst thing that anybody's ever done. Instead, she said, oh, I feel bad. That negative feeling is a signal. It's a signal about what I value and it's a signal about what I should do next. And so she has begun systematically collecting the stories of her parents, who I think are in their early 70s at this point, making an effort to collect their stories and assemble their stories. And so she has that sense of meaning. She has that sense of purpose. And it's a good example of the best way to deal with regrets, which is to use them as information, as data, as signals.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Randy is with us in Adams. Randy, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Randy?
Well, I just think another word for regret is forgiveness. You have to learn to forgive yourself. Because most people that have regrets, it's because it's their something that they have done and that they should have done. And if they learn to forgive themselves, they can work towards, like, say you said something bad to a friend or something and you regret it, and then it just eats at you and eats at you. You got to forgive yourself for saying it, and then maybe you can go to your friend and apologize.
Randy, thanks a lot for sharing that. Dan, what do you think about the forgiveness part of this?
No, I think Randy makes a great point. I mean, what she is calling forgiveness is an aspect of self-compassion, which is, you know, treat yourself as generously as you would treat somebody else. You know, the other thing that that Randy mentions is a pretty interesting distinction in the architecture of regret, which is regrets of action and regrets of inaction. Regrets about something that I did and regrets about something that I didn't do. So for things like, let's say you said something terrible to your friend, to use Randy's example, that's a regret of action. You can actually sometimes make repairs on those. You can apologize. You can make amends. You can make restitution. What's interesting is that what lives with people far longer than regrets of action are regrets of inaction. As we age, regrets of inaction, regrets about what we didn't do, outnumber regrets of action by about 2-1.
Randy, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Daniel Pink about his book, The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. Still time for you to share your thoughts, your stories, your questions at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dan, a thing that really strikes me here is a lot of the regrets, not all of them, but a lot of them are kind of, we become science fiction authors and craft the alternate history. What if I had gone to school or hadn't gone to school or married this person instead of that person or whatever. and our alternate history is way better than the one we're really living. How do we get over that one?
Well, it's an interesting question, because sometimes our alternate history is way better than the one we're living in now. But I think what really eats at people is not knowing what that alternate history was, and also not delivering at the moment. So, for instance, I have a lot of people who regret not asking, as we talked earlier, not asking somebody out on a date or something like that. But very few of them say, oh, if I had asked him out on a date, we would be married and have three kids and, you know, living, a beautiful life in Milwaukee. They're not saying that. What's gnawing at them is, in that particular case, is not stepping up at the moment of being at a juncture in their lives and having a chance to do something bold and shrinking from that chance. Now, you're right that the way we think about regret is to conjure these alternative histories. But what seems to bug people about a lot of these inaction regrets is not so much the outcome, but the decision itself.
Now, one thing about your four main buckets of regret, the foundation one, where I wish I'd taken better care of myself, planned for my financial future, and so on. It seems sometimes to contrast with the boldness one. I wish I'd taken that chance. I wish I'd done this thing on the spur of the moment. How do we reconcile those two? I wish I'd taken more risks versus I wish I'd hedged my bets better.
Yeah, that's a good question. The things that people did, I actually think there's actually a very close affinity between between having a stable foundation and having a psychologically rich life. I think that having a stable foundation allows you to take sensible choices. The foundation regrets that people were talking about were not, you know, when they spent money, they were spending money on frivolities. They weren't saying, oh, I tried to start a business and it failed, and therefore I'm in bad financial shape. I don't think I had anybody who said that. I had people who said, I earned an okay income, but I spent it going out to restaurants and buying cars and stuff that I didn't need. So the foundation regrets were very rarely a trade-off with boldness. They were something different. They were about kind of investments in oneself. It's not like people were being overly risky in compromising their foundation. They were being actually stupid in many cases. And when you have at least a stable foundation, that gives you a little bit more of the temerity to take that trip, to try something more adventurous.
We heard from Dean on the Ideas Network Facebook page, who writes, regrets equal fear of the past, worry equals fear of the future. Mm. Live in the now, Dean concludes. Easier said than done for me, Dan. I don't know. Is that normal?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not. I think it's not terrible advice, but I think that one of the things that you see in some of the research on the temporal side of human development and human flourishing is that what we want is in some ways an integration of the past, present, and future. What we want is we want the past to inform our present, and we want the present to guide our future. There is a very interesting personality psychologist at Northwestern University in fairly nearby Evanston, Illinois, and he says that people see their lives in terms of narratives, and there are two kinds of narratives. That he says, Dan McAdams is the guy's name. He says there are contamination narratives where things go from good to bad, and there are redemption narratives where things go from bad to good. And humans seem to flourish when they see their lives as redemption narratives. And the downside of living in the present only is that it's not a narrative. It is simply, you know, processing this particular moment and not seeing how it integrates into one's past, present, and future. And we know healthy flourishing depends, at least in part, on seeing your life in this narrative terms of making progress, of getting better, of moving from bad to good.
Dan, you talk at the end of your book about, this isn't just research you've done for research's sake. It has started to seep into your life. How has your long look at regret changed your own personal behavior?
Well, on these connection regrets, I have to say it's changed it significantly. So what happens with these connection regrets is that people have these relationships, often friendships, usually not, I'm not talking about romantic relationships mostly. I think about a friendship, and the friendship comes apart. And usually they come apart in profoundly undramatic ways. They drift apart. And one side wants to reach out and they say, nope, it's going to be awkward if I reach out, and the other side's not going to care. So it drifts apart more and it feels more awkward, and they think the other side's not going to care less. And they're wrong. There's a pile of evidence showing that that reaching out is far less awkward than you think, and the other side almost always welcomes it. And so for me, it's like, if I'm at a juncture where I'm saying, should I reach out or should I not reach out? Being at that juncture has answered my question. I mean, always, you know, reach out. If you're at that juncture, reach out. And that's changed me, because I'm not somebody who is like super social or super, you know, really good at reaching out. But this changed my view on it, because I had those misguided views of awkwardness and the suspicion that the other side wouldn't care. And I was flatly wrong.
Well, now, apart from reaching out, Dan, in our last minute or so, leave us with a bit of advice on how to start using regret in a happier way.
Yeah, well, I mean, what I would suggest with people is this. This week, have a conversation with someone about your regret. People want to talk about this. Tell somebody around a dinner table, in your office, hey, here's a regret that I have. Here's what I've learned from it. And here's what I'm going to do about it going forward. That simple process. Here's my regret. Here's what I learned. Here's what I'm going to do about it. That will trigger one of the richer conversations that you will have this year. I can almost guarantee it. It's a topic people want to talk about. It's a topic that we've made taboo, but it's a topic that can yield very powerful lessons in what we value and how we should lead a meaningful life.
Dan, thanks so much for sharing your research with us.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Daniel Pink. He's the author of a bunch of books. He was with us today to talk about his latest. It's called The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. You can find a link to information about the book at WPR.org/Central Time. And if you have thoughts on regret, maybe an experience to share yourself, there's still time. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, gas prices, no secret, they're pretty high. Government leaders are looking at ways to try and bring them down. We'll look at the latest efforts and proposals to help consumers at the pump in the weeks and months to come. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Tomorrow's school board elections will shape local education policy for the next several years. The results will have the most impact on a group of people who mostly don't have a say at the ballot box, the students. But as Madeline Fox reports, some Wisconsin students are finding other ways to make their voices heard. We'll come back to that story later, having some difficulty bringing it up. For now, though, gas prices remain high across the United States, but federal and state governments are looking into ways to provide some relief at the pump. Some states, not including Wisconsin, have created gas tax holidays, and President Biden is tapping into the country's strategic reserve of petroleum to make supply more available right away. It's led to questions about what actions would actually have an impact on gas prices and how sustainable those interventions are. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. How are higher gas prices affecting you? How would you like to see the government address the problem, if at all? Do you think it is the federal government's responsibility? Do you want to see states like Wisconsin at least temporarily cut gas taxes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Menzie Chin is a professor of public affairs and economics at the Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Menzie, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me, Rob.
Let's start by putting gas prices in perspective. I know at the nominal level, the actual numbers we see at the gas station, they're at record highs. When we adjust for inflation in real dollars, how do our current gas prices stack up?
Actually, it's a good thing that you mentioned that. I mean, I think there are two factors going on. First of all, we've seen this sort of whiplash in gasoline prices. So, looking back in April 2020, they were $1.84. per gallon on average nationwide, and now we're at 422. So you could be excused for thinking, wow, that's both a big increase over a short period of time, relatively speaking. But then, because we haven't remembered the fact that prices in general are rising, you might be surprised to find out that actually the price we're seeing right now is about, on average, the price we've seen over the last 30 years after adjusting for inflation. So that's exactly right. In terms of the inflation-adjusted price, we're pretty close to where we've been in over the past 30 years.
That said, COVID has had some impact on prices. It seems like the big low you mentioned, I believe, is because people weren't going anywhere, and that lowered demand for gas, a lot of industry shutting down for the short term. What has driven that wild swing from the lows to the highs now?
Well, exactly what you mentioned was that COVID shut down, big swaths of the economy, both in terms of work and in terms of leisure and driving around for leisure. So it's not surprising that prices dropped so low during the height of the pandemic. Since then, as you've seen, inflation generally has risen overall as demand for goods and demand for services have picked up with the recovery. So, we saw gasoline prices rising even before this latest round, and we shouldn't have been surprised in some respects that along with the price of everything else, gasoline prices should rise as we have this recovery. Now, on top of that, we have the supply interruption. So before, it was demand rising back to where it was or closer to where it was before. Now we have the interruption coming from first geopolitical jitters arising from the threat of an invasion and Russia being sanctioned and having the supplies of oil coming from Russia being taken off the world markets. But now we have it, the reality of actually removal of Russian oil supplies from the general global pool of oil. And so it's that's the case where we've seen oil prices jump from, about $90 per barrel back in beginning of February to $108 today. So as oil prices go, so too go gasoline prices.
In response to those prices, President Biden announced he'll be releasing 1 million barrels of oil a day from the country's strategic reserves. Here's some of what he had to say about the decision last week.
This is a wartime bridge to increase oil supply until production ramps up later this year. And it is by far the largest release of our national reserve in our history. It will provide a historic amount of supply for a historic amount of time, a 6-month bridge to the fall. And we'll use the revenue from selling the oil now to restock the Strategic Petroleum Reserve when prices are lower.
So when this oil starts flowing, Menzie, are we going to see a difference when we roll up to the gas station?
Well, at various times, we've encountered high prices in oil and of course, gasoline then is a political touchstone. And we've often looked for ways in which policymakers can reduce the price of gasoline when it's spiked. The Strategic Petroleum Reserve being tapped is one way in which the president has some influence over oil prices and hence gasoline prices. But it's not a big one. And there are two ways to look at it. First, the oil is in the ground and we have sort of semi-ready access to it. And so if you think about the big pool of oil that's out there that people can tap into, companies and so forth, refiners, well, it's kind of known that it's there and available. So in some ways, you don't expect it to have a big impact on prices when it's actually released into the general pool to be used. But another way of putting it in context is to think, each day, the president's proposing to release about 1 million barrels per day for a total of 180 million barrels, which is enormous, actually, relative to the fact that we've got about 565 million barrels in the reserve. So it's a big chunk of our reserve being released. And that's on top of the 50 million we released starting back in November. But what are we responding to? And in part, over the past 2 months, we've been responding to the possibility and then the actuality of sanctions on Russian oil exports. And so, what's relevant then is how much oil does Russia export? And it's something on the order of 5 million barrels per day of just crude oil and perhaps another 4 to 5 million of sort of petroleum derivatives and so forth. So, you know, you've got this big withdrawal of oil in principle from the supply in world markets, and you're only making up a portion of it. And so on the day that the announcement was made, you know, oil prices dropped about a dollar from the beginning, the opening of the trading to the close. And that reflects the fact that it's hard to have a big influence on a global market for oil just by turning on the taps on the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And that's not to say it's not a good idea. I mean, there are very few things that you can do, and that's one of them. And so what you're doing is you're trying to moderate prices a little bit and signal your willingness to try to do other things as well. So in some sense, I would say, you know, why not try something? This is a big change in oil and hence gasoline prices that you want to mitigate for the population.
Talking to economist Menzie Chin from UW-Madison about the price of oil and gas. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. David is with us in Eau Claire. David, hi.
Yeah, hi. I've got two comments and I think one question. My comments are, one, I think as Wisconsinites, we should be very happy to pay more gas. Well, here's my comments for two reasons. One, for environmental reasons. We are at a tipping point environmentally. And globally, we should all, as citizens, try and stop the burning of the fuels as much as we can. And the second reason we as Wisconsinites should be very happy to pay for more gas is to, in part, push for peace and disarmament in the world, in so much as that we're funding wars by our purchasing of oil and gas from various authoritarian regimes, as well as oligarchs in our own country. My question is, do you think that the current conflict in Ukraine will add a real push to the environmental impetus or in need that we really need to get off of these fossil fuels?
Got it. David, thanks for the call. Menzie, is this situation higher prices? And as David says, the Russian invasion of Ukraine adding impetus to getting away from these petroleum products in the first place?
Well, I think we've got lots of understanding that we do want to move away from a carbon-based economy in terms of fuels and so forth. And I guess to a certain extent, having this volatility in energy prices only highlights the dangers of relying upon energy, especially as that has to be produced and then shipped far distances to here to be consumed. So I'm hopeful. I'm not sure, because we have seen spikes in energy prices before, as in 2008. You know, the price of oil was in real terms much higher in 2008 than it is right now. And yet, you know, we still saw resistance and still see resistance to moving towards, for instance, carbon tax or some other way of imputing a higher price for use of fossil fuels. So I'm hopeful. I hope that happens. I'm not sure it will, in great part.
David, thanks for the call. We're talking to UW-Madison public affairs and economics professor Menzie Chin about gas prices and how to bring them down. If that's possible, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Would you want to see a Wisconsin gas tax holiday? How about a federal gas tax holiday? Would you rather get government rebates or direct payments? How much are high gas prices affecting you right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Menzie Chin, professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison. With us today, looking at gas and oil markets, why prices have gone up over the last couple of years. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see quick short-term action from state or federal government cutting gas taxes? What do you think of the idea of releasing petroleum from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve? Do you want to see the U.S. be less dependent on petroleum products? If so, how? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering what your guest thinks about whether we may have moved global de-dollarization into warp speed by finding ourselves now with oil being traded in other currencies and people, other countries are afraid to leave their foreign exchange reserves in our control.
Jim, thanks for that call. Interesting question, Menzi. I've seen Russia demanding rubles in some cases for oil and natural gas payments. Negotiations between Saudi Arabia, I believe, and China saying, hey, maybe we can sell and buy oil with something other than dollars. How big a deal is that?
So that's an interesting question. I should mention that the demise of the dollar as the international currency has been forecasted like 20 times out of the last 40 years. What's true is that the reliance on the dollar makes various countries vulnerable, and in particular, commodity exporters are even more vulnerable to the extent that almost all commodities are priced in dollars, and so typically you're going to see invoicing in dollars, and that's dollars are what they're going to be accumulating. And so the use of sanctions in this case, and this is not the only case, Iran beforehand, has definitely made it in the interest of various entities, governments that think they might fall on the wrong side of U.S. interests, has given them an impetus to try to diversify and get away from both use of the dollar, but also financial infrastructure like SWIFT and so forth, the international messaging system that banks use, that aren't under the control of the U.S. I guess the answer is yes. You've given a motivation for countries to diversify, but it's going to be costly, and so they're seeing the costs right now of being reliant upon the dollar. Maybe that'll move them towards, you know, trying to move away from use of the dollar. That's in fact what Russia tried to do, and we now see. In some ways, how ineffective it was. Yes, they diversified out of dollars in terms of the reserves, but a lot of their reserves are in other or with other central banks and other banks, which are now afraid of undertaking transactions because the U.S. would then sanction them for dealing with Russia. So, you know, it's not just the use of the dollar, but it's also the international infrastructure that's linked in by way of messaging systems, but by way of transacting with American banks and financial institutions. Diversifying away is very, very costly. And then you have to ask yourself, when the war is over and you go back to something that's more like normal times, these countries, are they going to be willing to pay the price to operate their own systems, develop their own systems, and to somehow have more reserves in, let's say, euros? I don't think they're going to diversify a lot into renminbi, the Chinese currency, because that will be very costly to use and transact. In the end, I'd say, yes, there's a potential for dethroning the dollar, but I don't see it as defining a big shift away from the dollar as the dominant currency in international transactions.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Janice in Lac du Flambeau. Janice, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I have driven a Prius for maybe 15, 20 years now. And I drive it because it's a hybrid and it cuts down on emissions, et cetera, et cetera. However, in the last 2 years when I have renewed my license plate, instead of the normal $85 that everybody in Wisconsin charged, $160, and so are everybody else who I know who drives an energy-efficient hybrid or all-electric car. And I talked to our lieutenant governor about this 2 years ago or so, and he said, well, it was because we weren't paying our fair share of gas taxes. In my opinion, the gas guzzler should be paying, raise the rate for everybody, and let the gas guzzlers get rid of their gas-guzzling cars and pay fewer gas tax.
Janice, thanks a lot for your call. Menzi, Janice getting into some of the finer points of government taxes and motivation when it comes to fuel savings. The rationale, as Janice was saying, for that higher fee was you're buying less gas, paying less tax to maintain the roads. Are we trying to sort out this policy on what we want to motivate consumers to do here?
So I think that's an excellent point and excellent question. I mean, you got to think about, you know, there's these proposals to give a tax holiday on gasoline. And so that seems like a good idea, but you have to realize that the gas tax does what? It provides about 60% of the funds in the federal highway funding for roads and so forth. That's at the federal level. There's probably more at the state level as well. And so, you know, those taxes are being used for something. If you provide a tax holiday, they're going to disappear. And at the same time, I think federal taxes are about 48 cents on each gallon. So it's not a particularly big chunk of the cost of gasoline. You're not going to have a tremendous impact given how high prices are now. So tax holiday doesn't make sense. From that standpoint, both standpoints, funding and in terms of impact. On the other hand, this issue about whether a hybrid should pay, I mean, that goes to the issue about who should be supporting the highway, the funding for maintaining highways and roads. And the fact of the matter is, a Prius, while it doesn't contribute as much carbon to the atmosphere, at the same time, it does impose wear on the roads. And so, you know, as you are moving away from gasoline as a power mode for vehicles, you know, you're running down the amount of funds that are available to be devoted to keeping the roads up, which everybody, both hybrids, electrics, and conventional vehicles, are using. While I think it sounds a little perverse, we should be encouraging the use of hybrids and electrics. You know, we do need to fund roads and highways. And so the question then is, how can we reformulate our tax system in order to do that in an efficient and equitable fashion?
Thanks for the call, Janice. We'll go to Bill now in Watertown. Bill, hi.
Yes, hello. Rebating a gas tax, you just talked about some of the drawbacks to it. Others are that if there's any excess profits going on right now in the oil and gas industry, and it's human nature that might be the case, wouldn't get rid of that. And so I'm thinking that we should be looking into excess profit taxes right now, wartime excess profit taxes, and then taking and rebating, putting a cap on that and rebating the excess back to those less able to pay. This high gasoline prices right now are a bit of a regressive tax for very poor people who can least afford it.
Bill, thanks for the call. Menzie, what do you think of that idea? Presumably somebody's making more money with oil and gas prices being higher. What do you think of the idea of a tax on that to help people who can't afford that gas right now?
Well, in principle, I'm sympathetic to it. The question is, I'm sure profits will rise somewhat. But it's true that, you know, for a gallon of gasoline, about 61% of it is accounted for just by oil. And so we have a rule of thumb in the business that for each dollar increase in the price of oil, you get, you know, about 2.5 cents increase in the price of gasoline. So, you know, if there's a big deviation from that and you get big increases in profits for oil companies, yes, I can see why you might want to redistribute the profits back to people. And that's probably better than some of the other alternative ways of trying to lessen the impact on households. I guess the question I'd ask is, you know, if you do rebate the profits, you know, in a way, you're giving that to people who would then presumably spend a big share of that still on gasoline. And that would just keep up the demand for gasoline. And part of the sort of market forces that we want to appeal to, especially if you're thinking about environmental concerns, is that higher prices will induce people to conserve on the use of gasoline. So yes, in terms of sort of mitigating the harm that might hit households who happen to be using cars as their gasoline-driven cars as their main means of transport, but it's probably not going to be completely equitable. And in some ways, it works at cross purposes with some of the things that you might want to do, including encouraging conservation.
Bill, thanks for the call. And Menzie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Menzie Chin is professor of public affairs and economics at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. With us today, looking at gas prices in the U.S. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, check out transportation projects around the state and share your local priorities. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Some people get excited when a new album drops or a movie they're looking forward to shows up in the theaters. Maybe it's a video game or a new piece of technology. Last Friday, there was a lot of excitement for some people with the long-awaited release of 1950 census records. Now, some members of my family are big into the genealogy, so they were right on top of this. Why are the 1950 census records coming out in 2022? It's the law. Census data, well, that gets used right away. The census every 10 years determines federal funding, voting lines, and more. But those individual records with the names and addresses and occupations and other stuff, federal law sets a 72-year waiting period for privacy reasons. Now, if you want to look yourself up if you're over 72 years old, or you want to look up members of your family or get rolling on that genealogy project, it's all there. You can find links over at census.gov. Census news you can use. This is Central Time.